Hello, and welcome to the Tuesday, January 25th, 2022 episode of The Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. This is Craig W. Hurst, Emeritus Professor of Music, podcasting from my music bunker, along with my faithful canine companion, Carmel the Wonder Dog, to share with you my latest musical interests and discoveries. I claim no special inside information about the latest or greatest music, nor do I know everything there is to know about music. What I am is a lover of music. I enjoy several genres of music, and I share with you what has currently caught my interest, old, new, outdated, and everything in between. Even old music is brand new if you've never heard it before. The universe of music is a vast one to enjoy. From my discussions, you might find something new to you and of interest to expand your own musical universe. I currently receive no compensation or motivation of any kind from any recording label, recording artist, or the estate of any performer or composer dead and gone to discuss their music and/or recordings. Now, with that out of the way, welcome to my musical universe. My guests today, that's right, I have two guests today, are Jameson Elder and Hannah Ray. Together, they are the duo Elder. When Jameson Elder and Hannah Ray met in Nashville in 2013, they were both fresh-faced singer-songwriters learning to navigate the musical landscape. Like many young Nashville artists, they met up several times to write. A mutual love of music led to a love of a different sort, and the pair were married in 2016. From the start, they always intended to record music together, but it just never happened. Despite being an incredibly difficult year, 2020 proved fruitful ground for the duo to finally go all in. They wrote and produced their debut EP, Nowhere Else to Go, almost entirely in their Nashville home while the nation was in lockdown. Both Jameson and Hannah began playing music at a young age in families where music was a part of daily life. Elder, who lived in suburban Atlanta in his youth, played in church bands, while Ray, who was raised in Staunton, Virginia, grew up doing theater. Both pursued their individual careers. Ray released two folk pop EPs, Rookie in the Ring in 2015, and 2018's Without Letting Go. Elder released two EPs, Where Beauty Remains in 2013, and Prodigals in 2017, and his debut full-length album, Prodigals and Thieves, with more of an Americana rock sound. They always intended to record music together, Ray recalls, that for years people would come up to us after a show and ask when we were planning on releasing music together. We just laugh and say, oh, one of these days. We talked about it a lot, but we just never fully dove in. There is a weird tension to co-creating with the person you love. It's different because you don't get to just set aside whatever conversation you had that morning. We had to learn how to create together. The two finally decided to finally join forces during the pandemic, marrying Ray's folk pop with Elder's roots rock, with influences ranging from Drew and Ellie Holcomb to the Lone Bellow, Ray and Elder found a way to meet right in the middle of their individual sounds. This project really started to just see if we could do music together, says Elder. As a married couple with individual careers, that can be a bit tricky. We have both had careers as individual artists, but this is our first true collaborative project, despite being together for almost 8 years. During the pandemic, the project turned into a way for us to process all of the news together. Our hope is that these songs provide some sort of salve for our listeners after a rough couple of years and hopefully bring a little joy into people's lives. While Elder is a project, is seeking to find new musical ground different from the two where the two have trod individually before, both Ray and Elder have had some unique career milestones of their own. Elder's music was featured on the TV show Nashville, and he toured as a guitarist for Nashville indie rock band Afterlife Parade, as well as for Matthew Smith of Indelible Grace. Ray's voice can be heard on more than a few ads. They have opened up for acts including Mark Roussard, Jason Isbell, and Amanda Shires, Lauren Elena, and more. New York Minute magazine has praised Ray's courageous honesty, saying that her music hits hard, and it also called Elder's music heartfelt and genuine, unmistakably original. It is my distinct pleasure to welcome Hannah Ray and Jameson Elder, the duo Elder, to my musical universe. Hello, Hannah. Hello, hi. Jameson.
Hello.
It's really great to talk with you. I've been looking forward to having you on my show, and here we are. A big question that I'm curious to know, because I've read your bios and listened to your music, both as a duo and your individual work as well. And each of you have individual careers in Nashville. Beyond the obvious that there are two of you performing in the duo Elder and that you utilize vocal harmonization in your music, what musical elements do each of you bring to the duo Elder that makes the two of you musically unique from either Hannah Ray or Jameson Elder individually?
Yeah,
sure. I think the first one is sort of on the songwriting side. Mm-hmm. Hannah tends to write a little bit more metaphorically, and I tend to be a little bit more narrative. And so when we bring those together, you know, we have to make some compromise or meet in the middle a little bit.
Yeah.
To find a balance there that like
works for both of us.
Yeah. I think as far as music goes, I mean, you're
I'm a little more pop.
Yeah. And I've kind of always had my hand in the roots side of things, and we both have a little bit, but I think with the Elder project, there's a little bit from my end. Hannah makes me polish things up a little bit more than I might otherwise. I tend to let things be a little bit looser, even on recordings or something. Also, the guitars are louder, so when I work with Hannah, I got to turn those down a little bit. But she brings that, I think, that part out of me. Mm-hmm. And I think for her, and she also brings a lot of like the vocal arrangement stuff that comes with it. And then on her side, I think I push her to get a little like grittier with some of the sounds on there.
Definitely.
Or like, I think that's a big part of it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But it's forever a tug of war, I think. Because we do have, we have some overlap in our styles, but we do have very different styles.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there's always some tug of war to kind of find that that middle ground, that space. It's like, okay, this is a little bit of you, a little bit of me. I got to do my guitar thing and layer all the guitars, and you got to throw in some cool,
stack like, all the harmonies.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So I think like that's probably where a lot of it comes from, is, you know, we borrow stuff
from each other. Yeah.
From our solo projects.
Mm-hmm. 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 So the whole, or the, you're stronger than, or the sum of your parts is stronger than the individual parts in many ways. I was intrigued by your statement that, Jameson, that you're more narrative oriented and Hannah's more metaphorical. Would it be fair to say then that Jameson, you're more of a storyteller, whereas Hannah, you're more of a scene creator or a picture, you know, through the use of metaphor?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that's a perfect description of our different styles.
Okay.
It's interesting too, because I think that there's a couple of the songs on this EP that are such good examples of that. Like, I think like Nowhere Else to Go is definitely a scene, like it starts in a scene, but there's a narrative to it that I don't know that we expected. So it's fun to kind of like,
it really blends the two, that song.
Yeah it really does. And we have to force each other out a little bit, because I think when I am writing, I get stuck in, okay, what happens next? Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's okay to just to kind of sit in that moment, space. Yeah. And with Hannah, there's a lot of, sometimes I'm like, that's really cool. I don't know what it means yet. So like, you know, pull it in a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think that's always a final tug of war. Yeah.
Well, I've always admired songwriters who just, you know, use the language for the beauty in itself, you know, put words together in a really creative way that draws an interesting mental image. I mean, I enjoy both types. I enjoy, you know, songs that tell a story, but I also enjoy those that create a particular scene, and you know, where you can almost smell the environment that you're in as it's described in the song. And it's really, I think, a really great combination. Well, you brought up about the new EP, Nowhere Else to Go, and you've kind of already answered this next question, but for the EP, were there any songs that were solely written by one or the other of you, or were they all collaborative?
Technically all collaborative.
Yeah, all collaborative. I think the joke is that Hannah usually starts writing the song first, and I have about 15 minutes to realize that it's a song that we need to do for Elder to get in the room and be a part of it. Otherwise, it's going to be done before I ever get there, because she writes really fast.
Really fast, yeah.
And like, Hannah's kind of one of those, like, she just gets it all out all at once, and I'm a very slow writer. And so they're all collaborative, but almost all of them, I think with the exception of one, are songs that Hannah started and I jumped in.
Okay. 80-20 split, probably.
Yeah. And then once we, you know, once we're in the collaborative process, I think, you know, it gets to be fairly, it's a fairly even split. Yeah. A lot of times I'll come in when she's got a first verse or a chorus idea, and then we'll work from there.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting, you know, how husbands and wives work well. I know, like with my wife, I'm a great idea person, but I'm a disorganized mess. And and my wife, although she has good ideas too, her real forte is organizing things.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So it's like, so, you know, it's kind of funny hearing you talk, because it sounds a lot sort of like the relationship I have with my wife. I'll get this great idea, then my wife will kind of more or less say, well, here, let me show you how we'll do it.
Yeah.
How we'll set it up, you know.
Yeah.
And she's always right, because it is. I kid you not, she knows how to do that way better than I do. And so that makes for a nice combination, nice working relationship as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Now I've got kind of a long question for you. So I'll try and take it in an organized manner so we don't lose track here. Now, I'm not here to pick a fight between the two of you or between the two of you and me or to start a squabble between the two of you. But I am sincerely interested in knowing about your creative working process, which you've kind of hinted at a little bit already. Now, since you self-produced your EP, how were you able to achieve the objective view of your work that an independent producer would have of your work, that other set of ears that is usually present in the studio who might critique what you're doing and offer suggestions of how to make it better?
Sure.
Now, I understand as a musician myself that we can always look at something we just put down and, on a recording and say, we could do that better. Mm-hmm. Or that was it, you know. What I'm getting at is the potential challenge of both of you looking objectively at a body of work you are creating and asking yourselves, is it working? Is this what we want? Did you have those type of discussions when producing the EP?
Yes, we did. Okay.
Well, then I asked a good question.
Yeah. We do have a history of recording together and doing a lot of stuff at home. We have almost always had a third party, even if they weren't in the room. It's actually the guy who mixed this EP, Dewey Boyd, has been involved in both of our projects for a while. Yeah. And a lot of times we'll do some stuff at home and then send it to him. He'll take it for a little while, you know, kind of workshop it. So we didn't do that on this record, which makes it really different because there was no third party. Time was the biggest thing. A couple of songs were pretty straightforward. So I think Safe With You and You're What Makes a Good Day, we had a pretty good idea right off the bat. Like, we know what these songs are. Yep. It's a matter of like finding the parts, finding the right sounds, but we know what the overall vibe is. Coming Undone and Nowhere Else to Go were hard.
Very hard.
I think we both had different understandings or ideas for what we wanted those songs to be.
Which were pretty opposite to begin.
Nowhere Else to Go especially, I think we had really different ideas. So we recorded the drums at a friend's place. And then I remember I recorded a bunch of things, like a bunch of guitars and bass, like just to kind of get a track. And Hannah heard it. She's like, I don't like this at all. Yeah. So I think for us, you know, one thing we learned was for this project was it's okay to set it down and walk away.
Which we had to do. Yeah. Several times.
Yeah. I think Nowhere Else to Go, like after that conversation, we didn't touch it for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And just, we need to sit with it. Mm-hmm. Don't touch it. Then there was a day Hannah was out of the house for the day, and I just, you know, tried to take some of the feedback she had from the first go around and then some of my other ideas and come up with something that was in the middle. And I think when she came home, I played it for her and she's like, this is much more on the right track, you know.
We're
much
getting somewhere. Yeah.
But it was a lot of like, I think there's a tendency to feel like every record you have to get it right the first time. And that was the really nice thing about recording at home, was we don't have to get it right the first time. We can come back tomorrow. We can come back in a week. Like, we have all the, like, my amp is always mic'd up. Like, it's not hard to re-record something. If it's not right, we're not right paying an engineer or a studio to do that.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's true. You have that luxury, I guess, if you're at home, the clock isn't running and the money isn't running, because I know studio time's by the hour or 3 hours, however you block it out. And you're always, when you're in the studio, you're always going, man, we can't waste any time. We just got to keep going, go, because every time you see that second hand go around, you know how much that's costing you. You know, I know what you mean. So at home, you got you got a lot more relaxed approach, and like you said, you don't have the pressure of getting the take exactly right the mm-hmm. first time, and that's really kind of a nice way to work. You're probably a lot less stressful.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a fine line, because then, you know, the time pressure can be a benefit sometimes, and not and having the open-ended.
Yeah.
But I think when we, you know, set a couple deadlines of like, we have to be done with this song mm-hmm. by this day, and mm-hmm. then that's enough pressure to keep us moving.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, because if you don't have any kind of deadline, it never gets done. Yeah,
yep.
I understand. Yeah. But I still think that's really kind of a way. I remember the last album I recorded with my jazz group, and just I was paying out of pocket for the studio time, and I kept thinking, oh man, you know, we got to get this and get it right, and you know, carrying the weight of the world on your shoulders. I'm curious to know then, you kind of alluded to this somewhat, but how much did the songs change from your original conception when you first completed writing them compared to the end product that went on the EP?
I feel like you should answer that one.
Okay.
I mean, I'll definitely echo what you said about Coming Undone and Nowhere Else to Go being the two that changed the most. Nowhere Else to Go, we actually ended up having to cut a few bars out of the song after we had already recorded drums, which was quite an adventure. But we just had such different ideas for the pacing for that song and the way that it should sound, that it was weeks and weeks of us kind of mining to find the right meet mm-hmm. in the middle. Mm-hmm. And Coming Undone, similarly, Jameson had a very different idea of what that song should sound like, and similarly had kind of done some production on his own, and I came in and it just was not the meet in the middle. We were not there yet.
She made me re-record the whole thing.
Yes, I did. Yes. But yeah, I think those were the two biggest, you know, kind of, we really had to go back and forth and do quite a bit of compromising on each end to find just the right sound.
I think it's interesting too, because I, you know, I have more of a production background, and so even when I'm writing the song, yeah, I tend to hear the parts, you know, or at least what the overall, this is what it's going to sound like when it's fully produced, and I tend to get that stuck in my head, which can be a good thing, you know, in some ways it can provide some direction for the song, but other times it's like, oh, I clearly have a different idea than what she has. Yeah. And mm-hmm. and for us to kind of get to both, you know, give a little bit to find that magical in the middle of place can be a challenge, just because like I heard it a very specific way when we started writing it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've always been curious, because I've interviewed a number of singer-songwriters who talk about how what they take into the studio is really just a bare skeletal framework. You know, they've worked out the lyrics, the melody, and the basic chords, and then the other musicians that they work with or the producer really add and flesh things out. Yeah. Now you mentioned in your promo materials that much of the EP was recorded in your home, but you did some work in a studio.
Kind of, not much. Studio would be a generous term. a drummer that I've played, because we recorded this kind of at the beginning of the pandemic, when a lot of the studios in town were closed. And I've got a friend who's a drummer who basically has an overdub room for drums. So he's got, you know, a drum room basically with mics and all that. So we, the first Safe With You we sent to him, he did that. We did that fully remote. We did Nowhere Else to Go and You're What Makes a Good Day. We actually went over there and did it there. But it wasn't like a studio. It was kind of his drum room in his house. Yeah. And then we did everything here in our little home studio. We've got an overdub room that's kind of set up mainly for guitars and keys and bass and stuff. We can't record drums here. It's not big enough.
Yeah.
But yeah, everything else was done here. The only thing that was in like an actual studio was when we did the mixing. A friend of ours owns a studio in East Nashville, and we've worked together for years. And so we mixed it at his place. Mm-hmm. But other than that, almost everything was done at home, and just the two of us, except for when we recorded the drums.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. And that saves me asking you a question, because my next question was kind of like the unique contributions of studio work to your songs, but you've pretty well have already addressed that, having done most of it. So let's
played everything except on the record. It was one of the house, two of us.
Well, I have, there's a blues singer from Boston I interviewed, not quite a year ago. And her album is, of course, up for Grammy consideration. And Erin Harp is her name. And she and her husband recorded that album in the living room of their apartment with but two guitars and a stomp board.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Wow.
Yeah. And and I'm hearing a lot of that from artists I've been interviewing over the last year, is really kind of what I think is cool, kind of stripped down, bare essence kind of sounds, which I really kind of enjoy. I mean, I actually enjoy all kinds of things, but just that kind of raw, honest, guitar and a couple of voices or something, and it's really kind of a nice sound to get away from all of the heavily produced music that we sometimes hear in the pop world.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to switch gears. And because I am a university professor, I am required to ask an academic question, philosophical question. And it's one I ask of every singer-songwriter. But, we talk about the ancient Greeks and the Romans. They used to say that the purpose of tragedy and drama was to serve as an emotional cleansing, a catharsis for those that were witnessing the drama. You could see the pain and agony that the characters were going through, and maybe vicariously experience those same emotions without actually having to suffer the pain and agony. So I'm curious to know, are the songs you write done with the idea of providing an emotional catharsis for yourself as reflections of personal experiences, or are they songs constructed to elicit a catharsis for others?
You want that one first? You want me?
I mean, I absolutely think I've always been the type of writer that writes from kind of a setting event, some type of big emotional event, whether it's a hardship or a moment of great joy. And so definitely for me, I think all of these songs came from all of the hardship that we were facing over the past year and just trying to figure out what to do with all of that and where to set it. And I think for others as well, that's my greatest hope with this record, is that it resonates with others in the same way that it has with us. And I think that is proving true. I have a couple friends. We have a married couple who we're friends with who have a kid, and they keep telling us about "You're What Makes a Good Day" being such a great song to dance to in the kitchen. And then, on the flip side, I have other friends that are still really struggling and who have said that they go home and they sit in the dark and they listen to "Coming Undone." And that's kind of just the greatest gift I could ask for with this record, would be to hear those kinds of things. So, yeah.
I think I would actually be a little bit of the other way. It's funny because Hannah writes very specifically from an event, and I think for me it's more often trying to figure out what I feel about something because I don't quite know yet. Our personality types are such that Hannah has very easy access to those feelings, and mine requires a little bit more digging to get to the root of it. So for me, a lot of times it's that exploration and that, what am I, how do I feel about this? And then I do think that I tend to believe with music that, as soon as someone else hears it, then it is no longer, I can no longer say that it's necessarily my song, because they're going to identify it with something slightly different than maybe what I had intended or what I had written or where that place for me, but that identifies with a specific place for them or a specific emotion or feeling or whatever. So in that way, anything that I write or play for someone, like that someone else hears, you know, is theirs to do with what they will. And mm-hmm. if that's to, you know, to find some sort of relief, to find some sense of like, oh, I'm not alone in this or whatever, I think that's up to them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I think you're spot on. I think that, you know, we've all had those experiences where we've had a performance and afterwards, you know, an audience member or, you know, you'll either hear from them immediately or if they contact you, you know, some other way, tell you how much your performance meant to them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you're really going, really? I mean, I thought it was just up there, you know, playing a 12 bar blues, you know, and what I had to say musically communicated something that resonated with him. And I think that's one of the things that we probably are going to discover more and more as things open up more and more, how much people have missed the communal making and consuming of music.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I
mean, I hate to bring up a cliche, but you know, it's like that old idea: if a tree falls in the forest and no one hears it, does it make a sound?
Yep.
You know, well, if a musician is just playing in their practice room and no one hears it, are they really making a sound?
Yeah. Yeah,
I hear you have a dog.
We do.
Well, that's okay. This is a very dog-friendly show. I want
that's
you to know
great.
That.
That's
because
great.
I have my faithful canine companion, Carnal the Wonder Dog.
Oh my goodness!
Is with me too. So yeah,
ours is. He's very much still a puppy.
Yeah, so, oh, that's wonderful.
Separation anxiety.
Oh, what breed of dog is it?
He's a lab pointer. So
okay.
German short hair. So basically, he's a ball of energy.
Yeah,
I gotcha.
And doesn't stop running.
Well, my Carmel is a purebred Shih Tzu, so she's only about 8 pounds, and she's almost 10 years old. So she's not quite as energetic as she was when she was younger, but she still has a bit of spunk left in her. And so, yeah, there we go.
Maybe a treat will help.
Yeah, we'll grab him something to keep him occupied.
There you go. Well, I'm going to go ahead and get on to talking about the songs on the EP. And I would ask if the songs on the EP are reflective of your personal life. And this is coming from my opinion as having listened to all these songs. I would have to say you are definitely a couple that's very much in love with each other. Because the songs range from Coming Undone and Nowhere Else to Go to Safe With You, My Love Looks Good on You, and You're What Makes a Good Day. And all the songs, and I don't know if this was, you know, intentional or not, but all the songs, as I listen to them, and my perception is that they all seem to orbit around a theme of reliance upon the love a couple has for each other to get through life well and happy.
Yeah, I think that's fairly accurate. I think that was also something that we were in the middle of learning during the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Even just during this time, I think there was, you know, I think everybody kind of has their story of particular hardship during this time, and we weren't strangers to that. And so I think, you know, at the end of the day, we kind of had each other physically, like we aren't hanging out with anybody else, so we better like hanging out with each other. You know, that's good. But also from a, you know, I just being a difficult time to share any of those feelings or what was going on with a lot of other people who, with really anyone else, like I think we were the only ones who really had any real insight onto what was going on for either one of us and our families and our, you know, our situation. And so I think there was a fair amount of the EP that came out of that. I don't know that it was intentional. I think it just sort of happened naturally. But where Hannah's the only person who knew intimately, like because of lockdown, because of a whole lot of reasons, but even more so than like really close friends, she's the one who knew very intimately like what I was working through or struggling with or feeling or whatever in that time, and I think vice versa.
Yeah.
And I think that came out. We didn't set out to write the songs that way. Like that wasn't something okay. that I think we didn't realize it until like we were almost done recording all of the songs or we're recording the vocals and like, oh, there's a through line here that we didn't catch. Mm-hmm. I don't know, does that ring true for you? That's kind of how it felt to me. It was kind of accidental, like, oh, it's there, you know, this sort of finding comfort or finding, I get to go back to earlier, catharsis with, you know, that one person.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I guess what I'm really suggesting in my description is that the entire EP resonated very well with me. Simply from the standpoint of the past 18 months mm-hmm. have been survivable for me simply because of my wife.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, she's also retired university professor. So we have that in common. We're both musicians. So we both love music. We, you know, we play together. We, you know, and I think we have an understanding of each other, and we, you know, when one's down, the other builds them back up and vice versa. And then that's the sort of thing that has helped us, I think, survive as well as we have, kind of being separated from the things that we have normally done. And that's just kind of a theme that I sort of picked up kind of from the songs on the EP.
Yeah.
That, you know, and so I, you know, to get to one of the specific songs I want to have you relay to my audience is the song Safe With You. Now, I understand it has an interesting story behind it.
It does.
A bit of feline inspiration. I understand. So share with my audience the story behind Safe With You.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it was probably around 1 a.m. one night, and I woke up.
Cold night.
Cold, very cold night in Nashville, and I woke up to the sound of screaming outside of our window, which is not an ideal way to wake up. So just immediately struck with fear and quickly woke Jameson and kind of told him what was going on and asked him to check outside to see if he could figure out what was happening. And he walked to the door. I heard him open the door, and then I heard him start laughing. And I was very confused by this because I was having a very different reaction. And so he walked back to the room and kind of seriously said, yeah, there is something going on. There's screaming outside of our window, but it's cats. there's a cat fight. And so we laughed it off that night. But just something about that moment the next morning stuck with me, just the fear and waking up that way, that I wrote Safe With You probably in about 15 minutes that next morning. Wow. Yeah, so, you know, a funny way to get there, but
yeah.
Safe With You is one of those songs that I got in on the very tail end of.
Okay.
Yes. So it finished a good amount of it by the time I came into the room and realized what was happening. It's like, oh, this is a good song.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, it really speaks well to, I think, to your relationship, that you feel safe, you know, when you've got Jameson there to protect you from cats.
You never know what's outside your window.
That's true. You don't. I you know, another song that I really enjoyed was My Love Looks Good on You. And mm-hmm. I particularly liked, and I want to talk about this musical structure of what I picked up. I really like the idea that you begin with a simple accompaniment mm-hmm. and Jameson singing a line, followed again by a simple accompaniment and Hannah singing the second line. Then you sing in harmony, again with simple accompaniment, finally bringing it all together with a fuller sound and the two of you singing in harmony. It is though you are saying, we're two individuals stronger as one couple. Mm-hmm. Now that's what I picked up just from not the lyrics, but the musical kind of structure and layering that you did.
Sure.
Would you comment?
Yeah, I think that's definitely on purpose. I think the structure of that song, you know, lyrically, it's very, gosh, I think exposed might be the right word, in the sense of, you know, that those opening lines, like, are very, I see you.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. it's kind of the idea there, or I see the effect that I have on you, and then vice versa later on in the song. Mm-hmm. So it's very almost exposed in that way of, like, I guess to get deep, like, for someone to truly love you, to allow someone to truly love you, you have to, there's a vulnerability that comes there. And so I think that is definitely intentional with how we structured the song. And I do like, I don't know that I had thought a whole lot of the idea of, like, the way the song builds the two voices really coming together to be one. But I think that's true. It's probably something we did just out of instinct more than on purpose. It just sort of felt like what needed to happen. But yeah, I think that, you know, because the harmony on that too is pretty, I think we've never really known which of us is singing the melody when we get to the chorus. It just sort of is, it's a, yeah, it's like, co-melody isn't the right word, but they're both, they could both exist independently as the melody. And I've always liked that. And then it comes back, the last line is unison. So we're saying notes. So it's kind of that same, it is that same idea of the two parts being joined offering slightly different things, and being, you know, they are different, but they function in harmony. And then at that last moment coming together, I've always really liked that part about that song.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it's really a very touching, very upbeat song that I liked. And I, you know, as typical of, you know, being an academic, we tend to overanalyze everything. So aside from all that stuff that I had to say, I mean, I just think it's a nice, upbeat, fun tune. I just really like it. Another one that caught my ear and I wanted to talk about is "You're What Makes a Good Day." Mm-hmm. Now, it has, in to my ear, more of a country sound to it.
Yep.
Because of the use of the banjo and the style of guitar inflections and the soloing. And I thought that this was somewhat of a musical departure from the previous four songs.
It is. Well, very much so.
I scored. All right. That's good to know. And I think that the nice thing about it, the really great thing about it, it's a wonderful song to close the EP with, because it has such a positive message about the support of mutual love in a relationship. And so did you place this song at the end on purpose? And if so, what was the purpose of having "You're What Makes a Good Day" as your last word on the EP?
Yeah. We put it at the end of the song because it didn't fit anywhere else. Because
so in some ways it was the outlier.
Absolutely. Well, and I think, you know, that song came a lot later when, you know, we were a little bit more able to hang out with people and see people. And so I think sonically, the idea from that song that I tried to replicate, you know, in a room by myself, was it sounded like a fun song to play in a circle of friends. And that's how I think we wanted it to feel, knowing that it would sound completely different from the rest of the record, but also knowing that, you know, as much as we tried not to be, this is a record that was created and informed by the pandemic. And so that sort of, what you were speaking to earlier of the communal element of music being lost a little bit, I think, like, that was part of what I wanted to recreate with this song from a production standpoint, was that, like, this is me and Hannah singing this song in a room with a bunch of friends. You know, I had to play the parts of a bunch of friends with that. But I think that once we heard it all sequenced, you know, played it in order, these are the songs, it made a lot of sense
to
close it. And it really, like, to the point about, you know, some of the other songs in the record about, you know, this is whole process, or these songs are learning to rely on someone else. You're What Makes a Good Day brings out the, like, okay, here's the fun part of that. You know, yeah. Like, mm-hmm. we do enjoy time together, or mm-hmm. like, you know, we can entertain our, when it's just the two of us, we yeah. can find a way to entertain ourselves. It's not always ideal and it's not always great, but it's still like, you know, in the middle of the pandemic, there was a lot of sorrow, but I do think, like, at least for the two of us, there were times that we laughed more than we've ever laughed, just because yeah. partly because we're stuck together. So we have more jokes than we normally would have. And
we're finding things funny, maybe that we would yeah. know.
Yeah. yeah. So I think that song allowed that place, you know, yeah. it's a little, sure. it's definitely less serious than the rest of the record, but I mm-hmm. think mm-hmm. we're not always serious yeah. either, and we needed a place to put that.
Yeah.
Well, I have to tell you though, and what came to mind is the great jazz musician and composer Duke Ellington. The mm-hmm. highest compliment that he could give anyone he would say that they were beyond category. Mm-hmm. But I think the highest compliment, maybe now I will start to give people, is you're what makes a good day.
Yes,
because I think that's a wonderful message, and just the nicest thing you could tell anybody. Yeah. You know, no matter what, you make it a good day.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I'm really curious to have you tell my audience that other than Cats, who or what is your muse, and who or what inspires you to write a new song.
Yours is a lot more obvious. Yours is,
yeah.
Mine is. I think mine is stillness to a point. I have to either absolutely need or be in able to find a place of stillness to write. And I, like, you know, there's a lot of different definitions of that, but a lot of times for me, I've written most of my songs while outside. Yeah. So I think for me, that's a place where it's just, you know, I can go, I am a write a song, and then 6 months later, I realize what it was about. with a couple of exceptions, I think it, mm-hmm. But in general, that's kind of where I land. And then Hannah's you just write.
Yeah, I mean, kind of going back to what I was saying before, I really have to have some type of setting event, and then it really flows, whether it be Cats, you know, or something mm-hmm. else that happens in life. But it usually comes from an event or a big emotional moment. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, in terms of the process of writing a song, and you each probably will have different answers, and that's great, but do you usually get, I mean, does a song start in your head as a melodic idea, a rhythmic idea, a particular set of chords, or do you start with a particular mood or emotion?
For me, I think that I kind of vacillate between a melodic idea and a lyric. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes I'll start writing in the car. Yeah. I don't know what it is about that. Yeah. But yeah, I think it's between those two
mm-hmm. to begin mm-hmm. when you think, I'm sorry, Hannah, I'm sorry for interrupting, Jameson. I was just going to say, Hannah, when you think of a lyric, does a melody that fits that lyric come to mind at the same time?
Often it is. That is the case. Wow. Yes. Yeah, mm-hmm. often they coincide. Okay.
All right.
Definitely not the case for you.
No, mine is a mood for sure. Mine always feels like archaeology, if that in some way of like this. I find a mood. There's a song that already exists in that mood, and I'm trying to uncover it, or I'm trying to dig it out. Mm. So I've often felt And I think this can drive her nuts when we're writing, because like there's usually a perfect phrase that exists out there that I'm looking for and I know is out there and it's on the tip of my tongue. But I most often start writing just playing guitar and like what's the mood there. I think that's where I begin to access that those emotions that, you know, then inform the song or the writing. But it's a lot of, I just want to find a vibe, and then I'll write what I think fits the vibe.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so then 10 months later, I know what the song's about.
Well, I think you know, I hear lots of different ideas. I love to ask that question because everybody has lots of different ways of coming, you know, about it. One composer I talked to just has snippets of vamps or particular chord changes that sound good, mm-hmm. and keeps a sketchbook, not a handwritten sketchbook. Some people do, but and that's what I was going to ask you. How do you, because you get ideas without fleshing out a full song. Do you keep sketchbooks of your ideas and then draw on them later?
I have an insane amount of voice memos on my phone that are mostly 30 seconds long. And as I come up with an idea or an addition to a song, I'm really bad about going and editing the existing one, and I just record a new one. So I'll have 10 different voice memos that are different parts of a song, or, you know, if I'm in the car, I don't think that it happened on this record, but it's definitely happened on other records where it's like, this song is missing a part. Yeah. It needs something. Mm-hmm. And I'll just be in the car and there it is. and then just sing it. So I'm definitely a voice memo, because a lot of times I will just write or I'll just play and I'll just sing gibberish. Like, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And I'll record it for 5 minutes and just, you know, follow the structure of a song. So verse, chorus, bridge idea, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And like, after I've done that, you know, the third chorus, I actually sing something that I meant to sing or that I like. And so I need that voice memo because I won't remember it, but I'll know that I did it.
Yeah.
And so I'll go back to that voice memo and reference like, that was the line for the chorus. And then a lot of times that's how I find those first few lyrics to kind of start outlining a song. Mm-hmm. So it's all voice memos.
Yeah. Mine's probably a combination of voice memos and just a folder on the notes app. Yeah. Usually starts with the first lyric of the song every time. And then I'll write it down and then I'll be in the car the next day and the melody will come.
Yeah.
If it doesn't come. Mm-hmm. And then I'll kind of fill the two together. So.
Yeah. I have notebooks full of writing exercises that I've done, are just like free writing.
Yeah.
And I've never referenced those as much as I would like to. Usually it just, maybe those are just sort of that first step to getting to the song where it actually needs to be. But yeah, it's,
Well, I just love adding to my collection and different people's, different songwriters' ways of doing things. I mean, and I've heard some really interesting stories from some people, like if they get writer's block, they sit down and they purposely write the worst piece of music they can think of.
Yeah.
just full of all kinds of dumb cliches or things that really wouldn't work, but just to get the juices flowing.
I do, and we did this for Nowhere Else to Go, because a lot of times what I'll do is I'll change the genre of the song, mm-hmm. or if it's an upbeat song, I'll slow it way down, like turn it into a ballad, or if it's more of a ballad, I'll turn it into like a rock song or whatever, not as the end result, but just to get past whatever that block is, and like, let's just change it up.
Yep.
Throw something different out there. I turned Nowhere Else to Go into like a very much like dum da da da, you know, like a very straightforward country song.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not like that. I was like, this is just for us to get an idea, like to find it. Like, we're not staying here at all.
It's really
helpful. Yeah, it's a boom chicka boom.
It'll show
boom.
You where to go next.
Well, you know, sometimes if you're, you know, I used to teach a class called Creative Thinking and Problem Solving. And one of the tenets that we used to, I used to discuss with students is that to come up with an idea, a good idea, one good idea, you have to have just a lot of ideas that you toss. And sometimes you have to define extremes. So at least you know where you won't go. And then you eventually kind of figure out and where it'll come together in the middle somewhere and something that'll work. So, and I guess that's one of the great things about music as an art form is that it is the most plastic of the art forms in that we can mold it, shape it, change it any way you want. And, you know, and I think about my wife and I have a trumpet and piano duo. And one of the songs that we love doing is the Beatles' Lady Madonna. But we don't do it at all like the way the Beatles do it. We do it as a down tempo, almost barrel house, honky tonk kind of, you know, song. And we love it. Now, I don't know if anybody else loves it, but we love it. And but, you know, to be able to take an established song and do it a completely different way and find that amusing is one of the great things about music as an art form.
Yeah. Well, it's fun. We've already talked about like taking a couple of these songs and just re-recording, like, you know, when we have time, re-recording them in a completely different way, just to see like what happens.
Yeah.
Well, it's like I heard a group out of New York. They did the, let's see, what was the old 60s hit, My Girl? Who recorded that? Four Tops? Anyway, I can't remember who first recorded it, but anyway, and did it like a reggae tune. Ooh. And it was so cool because they changed up, you know, you kept the melody basically the same, but changed up some of the underlying rhythm, and it works. And it's it was really kind of a neat song that way. So, you know, well, I could talk about this forever. And I think we're on the same page. Music is cool. I'm going to ask you a completely redundant question because I'm assuming, I was going to ask, are you currently writing any new material? And I'm going to assume that you're probably always writing new material.
Yeah.
And is there anything that you might give a sneak preview to my audience that they might hear on an upcoming recording?
Yeah, I think we both have several new songs that haven't been recorded. I think what we're trying to decide is
whether or not they'll be individual or elder.
Yeah. It's going to be some new territory that we're going to have to work out. Hannah has, you already have a whole record written that's ready to go whenever we get around to it. I have a handful that are close. I write a little bit slower than she does. I think that's kind of the plan, and then we're hoping to do like a very stripped down, just the two of us, acoustic version of this EP as well. Something else. I think kind of what you said earlier, just basically our two voices and guitar, like strip it down to bare bones and see what that brings out. And that's how we tend to perform. So it'll also be good practice, but I think that's probably what'll come next. And then you know, we got to write some more elder songs too. That's just elder. The two of us.
Well, that's great. Well, that really covers now my next question. You guys get an extra $5 in your Christmas Club account because you went ahead and answered the question, because I was going to ask you if you're planning your next EP or album, and it sounds like yes, you are.
I mean, that's the benefit of kind of having our own home studio set up, is like whenever we have enough songs that we feel like fit together, we can start recording. So whenever we get those and they make enough sense.
That sounds like a great way to do it, to, you know, create content. That's great. The next question I have, many of my guests find is a hard question to answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway, and I'm going to ask it of you. You can respond either as elder or you can respond as individuals. But what have been some of your more memorable experiences of your musical career?
Do you want to start? Do you want me to start?
You can start. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is kind of, I could kind of answer this for Elder.
Yeah.
Although this is also individual, but Jameson and I actually met working at a nonprofit in Nashville for adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Okay. And every year they would have a giant fundraiser. For a number of years, it was Amy Grant, which was amazing. But one year, Jason Isbell played, and we actually got to open, which was pretty amazing. Definitely a snapshot moment for me.
That was also the first time we played My Love Looks Good on You
it
in
is
public.
Yeah. So kind of the debut of Elder, really, there.
I think that's
at the top of my list.
I remember a house show that I played in Nashville. And I had just written a couple of the songs that would be on my full length. I think it was might have been the first two songs I wrote for a record I put out called Prodigals and Thieves.
Mm-hmm.
And I played those. And one, getting anybody to respond to your music positively in Nashville is hard, because everybody's a musician and everybody sits in the back of the room with their arms crossed. But I played those songs and I remember feeling like this is the sound I've been trying to make for years.
Yeah, you kind of landed.
Yeah, and these two songs in particular, it was very much this is it. And it, you know, there were maybe 10 people, 15 people there, but I do remember feeling like this is the first time I played any of these songs and this feels right. Mm-hmm. This is the direction musically I want to go.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you really kind of found your niche.
I think that's, so. Yeah. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Or, you know, and you know, as any artist will say, there's plenty of the self-doubt or am I any good at this? Mm-hmm. And I think playing those two songs and like, oh, these are good songs. Like I would mm-hmm. listen to these songs if I didn't write them. And that's a good it. Thing. Mm-hmm. Yes,
well, and we all reach that. I think we can all reach that moment where, you know, Clark Terry, who's a great jazz trumpet player, used to always say, first you imitate, then you innovate.
Mm-hmm. Mm, yeah.
And I think, you know, maybe we all kind of start out that way until we find out who we are or what we are is the product of various combinations of things, but yet it's unique. And we kind of feel comfortable in our own skin. So to speak, yep. instead of covering somebody else's music or performing on somebody else's record or whatever. And that's really kind of a neat feeling because then you finally, it's sort of like, you know, that existential moment, if you will, that you realize that you are independently alive and sentient and musically speaking and all that kind of stuff. So that's really pretty cool. That's pretty cool. Well, I only have one more question to ask you.
Okay.
That was Carmel barking. Anyway, she woke up from her little nap here and she's looking at me like, Daddy, are you about done? the last question I have to ask you, is there anything else you'd like to add or tell my audience that I have not asked you about?
Oh, man.
Maybe where to find us.
Yeah, there's that. It's really hard to record an EP in your house with a new puppy. That's something that we learned.
So that was an extra challenge. Yes.
Especially when Hannah's in the middle of recording vocals and the dog starts barking out the window.
And it was the take, you know, every time.
Yep. I think, depending on what the coming months look like with the pandemic and everything, we're hoping to get out and start playing some shows again. It's been a long time since we've played shows that weren't live streamed. So I think that's one thing we're really looking forward to being able to get on. I can't think of anything else other than, you know, all of the shameless self-promotion things that you're supposed to do, like the website and all the social media and all that stuff.
All the handles.
Well, just so you know, and also so to remind my listeners, I include in my show notes links to your website, links to your Facebook page. Yeah. I've got links, YouTube links to some of your performances. So when people go to my website or my Facebook page for the musical universe of Professor Hurst, they'll get the show notes and the link so they can investigate you further if they choose to.
That sounds great.
One other thing I did think of, there is a nugget. We'll call it the Easter egg in the EP.
Yes.
It is on your What Makes a Good Day.
Yeah.
There's a guitar solo in there, but there's also what we affectionately call Hannah's mouth trumpet. And Hannah's jokingly made this sound for years, usually as a party trick, of like she makes a fairly realistic trumpet sound with her lips. Well, when we were recording your What Makes a Good Day, we needed another half of the solo.
Yeah.
And Hannah did it as a joke.
Okay, I'm going to go back and listen to it as soon as the interview's over.
And then we harmonized it, and it turned into a whole thing. Yeah. And we couldn't record it without laughing.
Yeah, it probably took a solid 45 minutes to an hour to get that part down.
So that's the Easter egg if you find it.
Yeah.
Okay. As soon as we get done, I'm going back and listening because, you know, I'm a trumpet player and I'll really be able to judge your mouth trumpets.
Yeah, I hope I
will.
All right. Well, Hannah and Jameson, thank you for taking time to talk with me today. I want to wish the best with what I'm sure will be a continued successful musical career.
Thank you so much.
We've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, this is wonderful.
You bet. You have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, you too.
Thanks.
My discovery composer of the week is Salvatore Di Vittorio. Born in Palermo, Italy, in 1967, Di Vittorio is heir to the Italian neoclassical orchestral tradition, following in the footsteps of Ottorino Respighi. He gained considerable attention with his completion of Respighi's first violin concerto in A and other works by commission of Respighi's great nieces Elsa and Gloria Pizzoli and archive curator and cataloger Poito Pedara. Di Vittorio is founding music director of the Chamber Orchestra of New York, which debuted in 2007 at Carnegie Hall's Zankel Hall. His Naxos recordings with the orchestra continue to air worldwide, receiving much critical praise. He has worked with numerous orchestras, including the London Philharmonic Orchestra, Teatro alla Scala Opera Orchestra of Milan, San Diego Symphony, Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia, Orchestra Sinfonica Siciliana, and Teatro Massimo Opera Orchestra of Palermo. Di Vittorio is fascinated with the world of storytelling, and best known for his lyrical orchestral poems, including program symphonies, which are often inspired by classical antiquity and show connections to the Italian Renaissance and Baroque. Under his baton, Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia world premiered his Ode Corelliana in 2017, after the successful premiere of Venus and Adonis in 2016. The San Diego Symphony world premiered his orchestral Fanfara del Mar, su a tema di Monteverdi, on a theme of Monteverdi, commissioned for the centennial of Balboa Park at Copley Symphony Hall. In 2012, Di Vittorio made his conducting debut with Orchestra Sinfonica Siciliana at Teatro Politama Garibaldi Giornale di Sicilia, praise the evening from Pines of Rome to the Temples of Sicily, depicting Di Vittorio's Third Symphony as a commemorative memorial with a dimension of insularity, which during great peaks reveals suggestions of an international musical palette. La Repubblica acknowledged Di Vittorio's neoclassical works, and in particular his Third Symphony, as his first composition to capture Respighi's Impressionism, together with influences of Berlioz and Richard Strauss. Mayor Leoluca Orlando awarded Di Vittorio the Medal of Palermo, recognizing the great importance of Di Vittorio's work as a promoter of Palermo around the world. Di Vittorio began his musical studies at an early age with his father, Giuseppe, who introduced the operas of Verdi and Puccini. He studied composition with Giampaolo Bracali, later conducting, and Ludmilla Ulea at the Manhattan School of Music, and philosophy at Columbia University. He is a protege of such esteemed conductors as Piero Bellugi. His compositions are published by Panastudio Casa Ricordi, which is Universal Music, and recorded on Naxos Records. With La Villa d'Est e Tivoli in 2016, Di Vittorio reached a significant milestone when he became the first composer to dedicate a work to the Morgan Library and Musician, and the first Italian composer during his lifetime to be invited to donate an autograph manuscript to the museum's world-renowned music archive, followed in 2019 by donations of manuscripts of his completions of Respighi's Violin Concerto in A and Tre Lyrici. The All Music Guide lists 13 recordings of Di Vittorio's compositions, including choral, chamber, and orchestral works. In my show notes is a link to Di Vittorio's recording orchestral works released in 2021 on the Naxos label. That wraps episode number 66. My show notes, along with links to artist websites, recording label websites, YouTube videos of artist performances, are all posted on my Facebook page, The Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. Coming up next week, I'll be interviewing Cassandra Caxor, a Chicago-based pop rock and avant-garde musician and composer. Upcoming interviews include David Wimbush of the indie pop band The Collection, jazz trumpet player Farnell Newton, husband and wife duo The Bergamont, and jazz vibraphonist Ben Galise. So don't touch that dial and stay tuned. If you have questions, comments, or a suggestion of an artist, composer, or musical style for me to consider, you may email me at hurst@uwm.edu. So until next time, this is Professor Craig W. Hurst and Carmel the Wonder Dog, signing off from The Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. Have a great day.